So tonight we move into chapter 3 on the creation of the world. The first 2 weeks we focused on chapter 1, which is a general introduction to the Bible. The next 2 weeks were a general introduction to the Old Testament. Tonight we're finally getting into the Bible itself. We're going to take really just chapter 1. We'll be referring to some other references in Scripture, but essentially what we're going to be spending our time with tonight is chapter 1 of the book of Genesis. Last week we talked about the Pentateuch, the five first books of the Bible. One of the things that we noted is that there are four separate strands of traditions that have been woven together by some editor at some point into these five books. This would the Yahwist, which is J, the Eloist, which is E, there is the Deuteronomist, which is D, and there is the priestly tradition, which is P, and that these are all woven together. What we have here in the introduction, or in the first chapter of Genesis, is really an attachment to the entire Bible. It is written virtually as an introduction. It is not really part of what takes place after that. And one of the reasons we can say that is that we could drop that chapter off and we would not miss it. We would not feel like something was missing from the Bible if it had never existed. So that kind of indicates, okay, this was attached to the beginning of Genesis at a later date. There are two stories of creation, as we're going to see. One we're going to focus on tonight, which is in chapter 1, and in the chapter 2, there is a different story of creation. The first one that we're going to be focusing on tonight is a great poem or hymn of creation, and the second one in chapter 2 is more of a narrative, which is setting up the story of the fall and getting us ready to see how is it that if God created everything wonderfully, how did it end up in such a mess? And then what do we go do from there? From that point on, we begin to look at salvation history. But tonight, we're just going to look at this great poem of creation, this great hymn of creation. How do we know that it's a poem? Well, it's structurally, it's a poem. If you look at your Bible, I'm just going to talk about, first of all, how the structure is laid out. Each day is a different section, and each day we see where God says, let this happen, and it happens. We also see God then commenting on what it is that he has created, saying, and it was good. When we finally get to the sixth day, when he creates animals and he creates us human beings, then at the end of that day, he is going to say, and it was very good. When we look at these 6 days of creation, and then one day, which is going to be treated separately, which is the Sunday or the Sabbath, in these 6 days of creation, how is it that God creates? There are going to be essentially 3 days in which God is going to be separating something from something else. And then the last 3 days, days 4, 5, and 6, are when God actually begins to populate this universe that he is creating. So again, there's a very structured, organized way of stating this. And so it shows us that it is a poem. Narrative is not written this way. So let's just go through and we're going to read from this and kind of pick up some of the things that it's teaching, and then I'll be going back and covering major sections of it. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless wasteland, and darkness covered the abyss, while a mighty wind swept over the waters. First of all, in the beginning. The word beginning for the Hebrews was Genesis. And the first word of the book of Genesis is Genesis. Guess why they called it the book of Genesis? This is how the Hebrews came up with the names for all of their books of the Bible, was whatever the first word or maybe the first significant word of that book was, that became the name of that book of the Bible. So in the beginning, in the Genesis, when God created the heavens and the earth, already we are moving into some profound theology that does not maybe strike us so much, but would have struck the people of the Jewish time when this is emerging. It is a radical statement. Why? The Jews were surrounded by pagans. They're surrounded by pagan religions, and virtually all of the pagan religions agreed upon one notion, which was spirit is good and matter is bad. And so they believed that God perhaps created the heavens, which would be the spiritual world, but that he could not have created the earth. He certainly could not have created these carnal bodies that we have, that we possess, because that is, it's too dirty, it's too weak, it's too broken, it's too sinful. Therefore, God created the heavens, he created spirit, but he did not create the earth. Many of them had myths, or almost all of them had some kind of a myth about how the material world came into being. Often, there's a great war between two gods, and one of the gods gets killed, and the god who lives takes the god who got killed and tears him up and throws his body all over the place, and it becomes the material universe. And so the material universe is made up of the dead body of this defeated god, who is also usually the bad god, all right, the bad evil god. And so that's why matter is seen as evil. So spirit is good, matter is evil. Suddenly, as this Jewish community is emerging in the midst of these pagan notions, they have a very, very different take on creation. What is it they say? In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, there's a number of things going on here. First of all, there is one God who is involved in this. These are monotheists, not polytheists. They are not pagans. They are the first people that are emerging on the earth who have faith in one God, who believe that there is only one God. All of the other religions believe in many different gods. They believe in one God. And they believe that this one God created both the spirit world and the material world. They are proclaiming through this statement is that material reality is good. Material reality is good. We're going to see this as we move on, and every time God does an act of creation, he is going to say, and it was good, it was good, it was good, and it was very good. There have been, throughout history, these different religious groups who always come back to the same notion. Spirit is good, matter is bad. Christianity has been strongly influenced at times. Even though the church has officially declared this to be a heresy, it has still been a constant influence within Christianity. One of the there was a religion back in the 4th, 5th centuries or so called Manichaeism. Manichaeism was one that taught this very doctrine, that all matter is evil and that all spirit is good. There was a very famous Manichaeist who was converted to Christianity and became a very famous Christian. Does anybody know who that might be? Saint Augustine. But he came from that position. But as we know, some of the attitudes of the Manichaeists, even though they've been officially rejected by the church, have found their way into common spirituality. Did anybody here, as you were growing up and going through Catholic schools or going through CCD classes or growing up in a Catholic home, pick up some negative notions about the body and about sex? Anybody in here? All right. This is the effect of Manichaeism and its various forms throughout history, which has continued to have impact. Even though the church has officially rejected it, it has stayed an influence. It has been a temptation within the church constantly to look at the body as bad, to look at sexuality as bad, as dirty. Sex is dirty and nasty, and you should only do it with somebody you really love. All right? Nobody laughed at that when I said that at noon today. They were like, what? That's intended to be a joke. But isn't that the message that a lot of people were getting? A lot of good Catholics were being presented with, and who were presenting this, whether to their kids or to their students or whomever. That's the message that was coming out. That is not what we believe. That has never been what we believe, but it has in fact been the part of the temptation. Last year, when we went through and talked about the theology of the body, and we learned about the magnificence of the body, one of the things that we discovered in studying that, and people are still surprised when I say this, is that it is in our sexuality that we are most like God. Our sexuality is, in fact, our most sacred and the most sacred and holy aspect of who we are. It is the most godlike faculty that God has given to us. Because what are the two purposes of sexuality? Right? The love that is expressed between the husband and wife, and God is love, and the way in which the husband and wife share in the creative act of God in bringing forth children. It is the most sacred and holy act that we are capable of. It is the most sacred and holy aspect of who we are as human persons. Now, if Satan wants to lead us off track, what might he attack first? And what might he attack most viciously in terms of our understandings and our ideas? Might he try to convince us that sex is dirty and sex is bad? Might he also try to convince us that kids are a burden? The children are a curse, and so we only want to have as few as we absolutely can get away with. All right? Is this not the way Satan might very well choose to attack God's creation and to mislead us in our relationship to creation? So, right from the beginning, some very profound things are happening right in these first verses that maybe can challenge even some of our own attitudes, the attitudes that we've absorbed from the culture that we live in and from the church that we live in, not its official teaching, but it's what has been sometimes distorted in the unofficial teaching. Let's go on. So God has created the heavens and the earth, and the earth is a formless wasteland, and darkness covered the abyss. The abyss is this great emptiness, and there is the earth that is there. Now, we don't know. It doesn't say where the earth came from. It doesn't say God created the earth. It just says the earth was a formless wasteland, and darkness covered the abyss, while a mighty wind swept over the waters. The waters are very important here. We're going to see that their image of the beginnings of creation, of the is chaos. There's total chaos going on, and there are waters. It is just, the universe is water. It is water, and the earth is kind of floating there in the waters. And then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw how good the light was. God then separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. Thus evening came and morning followed the first day. All right? He has separated, he's created light, and he has separated the light from the darkness. He has called the light day, and he has called the darkness night. Then God said, "Let there be a dome in the middle of the waters to separate one body of water from the other." Now what's going on here? This dome. Here's how they understood that. Again, these are flat earth people. All right? They do not have the concept that we have of a round earth. They believe in a flat earth, and so they see the earth as this plateau or something like that, and then there is a dome over the top of the earth, all right, that goes from the horizons all the way up, and that there are waters. Again, originally there's water everywhere, and so what we're seeing here is he's creating this dome, and it goes, and so what happened? God made the dome, and it separated, again we have separation, the water above the dome from the water below it. So they're looking up at the heavens, and that's what they imagine that they see up there. They imagine they see this dome. And above that dome, there is water. All right? And originally, below that dome was all water. And so what happened, God made the dome, and it separated the water from the dome, above the dome from the water below it. God called the dome the sky. Evening came and morning followed the second day. Now let's talk about some literal interpretation here. All right, there are those who want to interpret this absolutely literally. And if you want to do that, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. All right. I want to make sure that what we focus on is what the story is trying to tell us. If you sleep better because you believe that there is actually a dome that is over the heavens, all right? Then believe in that, all right? Believe in that. If you believe that that is just a figurative way in which a pre-scientific people are trying to describe the universe, and they are using their common understanding in order to get at real spiritual truth and theological truth, then that's okay too. I'm not going to get into that. I'm not going to get into that. That's not my problem. We have the Answers in Genesis people, right here in Boone County, right here within this the boundaries of our parish. They are building a museum, which is a creationist museum. If you talk to them, they will tell you that the earth is 6,000 years old. It was created 6,000 years ago by God. God planted, like, the bones of the dinosaurs and things like that in order to test our faith, to see whether we would really believe him when he says it's 6,000 years, or whether we would think we would trust scientists who told us that these things have to be millions of years old. That he tested us. So you go over to the other side of Boone County and you have Big Bone, all right? Well, God's just testing our faith with all that, all right, by putting mastodons and that sort of thing. I also saw in the paper a few weeks ago, there was a letter to the editor by somebody who's connected with Answers from Genesis that was somehow got, I don't know what they were reacting to, but it's obviously something about the Grand Canyon and the statement that someone had made that the Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon over a process of millions of years. All right, that's what we've all learned, right? Well, they're saying, well, no, because the Earth is only 6,000 years old, and that could not have happened, and that it was somehow was carved out in some other remarkable way. I don't remember exactly what their explanation was, but fundamentalists, I think, get themselves in trouble with this. All right, especially if you're going to say, okay, this dome that is the sky, all right, this dome that keeps the waters on the other side. So they believe, they don't have a concept of a universe that goes on and on and on. They see a dome and they think there's water on the other side of that. In fact, they believe that when it rains, what's happened is that God is opening up doors in that dome and is allowing the rain to fall down, all right? So he has created the dome, evening came and morning followed the second day. Then God said, let the water under the sky, all right, under the dome, all the water that's here, be gathered into a single basin so that the dry land may appear. And so it happened. Again, he's separating, first he separates light from darkness. He separates the water above the dome from the water below the dome. Now he's separating the water below the dome from the dry land. And so what happened, the water under the sky was gathered into his basin, and the dry land appeared. God called the dry land the earth, and the basin of the water he called the sea. Remember, they live right on the Mediterranean Sea. God saw how good it was. Do you see these patterns keep following through on each day on how this is working? Then God said, let the earth bring forth vegetation, every kind of plant that bears seed, and every kind of fruit tree on earth that bears fruit with its seed in it. And so it happened. The earth brought forth every kind of plant that bears seed, and every kind of fruit tree on earth that bears fruit with its seed in it. God saw how good it was. The evening came and morning followed the third day. In this first 3 days, God has essentially created the universe. He is now going to start populating this universe. He has set it all up so that life can exist. And now he is going to start populating it. Though interestingly enough, the first thing he populates are the heavens. Then God said, let there be domes, lights in the dome of the sky. And again, what is it that they believe? They believe there is this dome and that there are these lights that are in this dome. All right? They have no concept of stars as stars. They have no concept of all. All they see are these lights that are up there. They see the constellations, etc., etc. And to them, it's like in this dome, there are individual lights. Among the pagans that they are emerging from, they're looking up and seeing the same sky, and what they believe is that every one of those stars that they see is the home of a god. All right? That's what the pagans are believing. Now, what the Jews are saying here, what the Hebrews are telling us, is that there is one God who created all of those stars. All right? Whatever they are. They don't have any understanding that every one of those stars is a blazing sun. All right? That quite likely may have its own solar system. They have no way of knowing that. This is a pre-scientific people. They're dealing with what they've got, but they're wrestling with not scientific questions, but with meaning questions of who are we and how did we get here and who is God and what is God about and what are we about. They're dealing with these kinds of questions. And so God said, let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate day from night. Let them mark the fixed times, the days and the years. They notice that the constellation of the sky changes through as the year goes through. And serve as luminaries of the dome of the sky to shed light upon the earth. There's nothing in there about there's gods living in those little houses up there. That's the lights in their house. And so it happened. And God made two great lights. The greater one to govern the day and the lesser one to govern the night. And he made the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to shed light upon the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. God saw how good it was. Evening came and morning followed the fourth day. Now, again, if we're interpreting this thing literally, does anybody see a problem with God creating the sun and the moon and the stars on the fourth day? What did he create on the first day? Light. Where was this light coming from? All right. We have light before we have a sun, before we have the stars. All right. This is a pretty scientific people. They're doing the best they know how, but they're not trying to come up with scientific answers. That's not their purpose. That's not their meaning. They're trying to come up with theological answers to meaning questions. Let's move on. Then God said, let the water teem with an abundance of living creatures. So he populates the heavens. The next day, day five, let the waters teem with an abundance of living creatures, and on the earth let birds fly beneath the dome of the sky. And so it happened. God created the great sea monsters and all kinds of swimming creatures with which the water teems, and all kinds of winged birds. God saw how good it was, and God blessed them, saying, be fertile, multiply, and fill the waters of the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. Evening came, and morning followed the fifth day. So the first life above vegetation that begins to emerge begins where? In the sea and in the air. You know what's amazing? What's amazing? This pre-scientific people is actually getting it right. All right? They're actually getting it right. The evolutionists would tell us exactly the same thing. All right? That what first forms is plant life, and then the first forms of animal life that begin to emerge are in the sea. And coming from those same origins are going to be birds. All right? And so they're right. Then the sixth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth all kinds of living creatures, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of all kinds. And so what happened? God made all kinds of wild animals, all kinds of cattle, and all kinds of creeping things on the earth. God saw how good it was. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and the cattle, and over all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that crawl on the ground. God created man in his image. In the divine image he created him. Male and female he created them. God blessed them, saying to them, be fertile and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and all the living things that move on the earth. God also said, see, I give you every seed-bearing plant all over the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit on it to be your food. And to all the animals of the land, all the birds of the air, and all the living creatures that will crawl on the ground, I give all the green plants for food. And so it happened. God looked at everything he had made, and he found it very good. Evening came, and morning followed the sixth day. This is the most important day so far for us to really reflect on, because it is where we begin to emerge. We begin to emerge from creation. Human beings are portrayed as the final creation of God. We are the crowning glory of God's creative acts. Right? Everything that has come before is preparation for humanity. And everything that has come before is actually given over to us. Now, a few things we need to go back and just read and say, what's going on here? Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. Does that raise any questions for anybody? Who's this us? Who is this us he's talking about? All right? And I got to tell you, I don't know. The fathers of the church, all right, some of them in the very earliest centuries, they're looking at this and trying to figure it out too. And they say, well, it must be the Trinity talking to each other. All right? Maybe that's what's going on. This is thousands of years before the Jewish people who are writing this have any concept of a Trinity. Others are thinking, well, maybe it's God speaking to the angels. He's already created the heavens. He's already created the spirit world. So perhaps he is speaking to the angels and saying, let us create man in our image. All right, because we are created in God's image and likeness. But we also have that image of the angels. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. The reality is, we don't know exactly, because the scriptures never explain themselves. This is an odd passage. All right? And when people are starting to study the Bible carefully, this is one of the first ones they come up to and go, what? Who is he talking to? Let us make man in our image after our likeness. Let's move on. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and the cattle, and over all the wild animals, and the creatures that crawl on the ground. I'm going to get back to that dominion thing in a moment. God created man in his image. In the divine image he created him, male and female, he created them. What does that mean? Does that mean that God looks like this? That God has a body and that he has created us, our bodies, in the image of his own body? Is that what it means? No. God is spirit. Therefore, he does not have a body. By definition, God does not have a body. So that is not what it's referring to. It is our souls. It is our spirits that God creates in his image and likeness. And what is that image and likeness? It is the capacity to do two things. There are two faculties of the human soul. To know and to will. To know and to will. Intellect and will. These are the two faculties of the soul. To know, to learn, to understand. We are the only creation in material creation who have the capacity to know, to will, to choose. Animals act by instinct. They don't have the capacity to evaluate data and then make a decision. They can't do that. Only we human beings have the capacity to will, to choose in material creation. We are the only ones who possess that because that's our spiritual nature. Now, we do share that spiritual nature, obviously, with God, because that's what God has created us in his image and likeness, his capacity to know and to will. He has also given those same two faculties to the angels, to his spiritual creation, that they have the capacity to know and to will. So, what is this telling us? First of all, that we human beings are the meeting place between the two great worlds of creation. The heavens and the earth meet in us. We are the only creatures which have the spiritual nature and this material nature combined. All right? You got that? All right? We're the only ones that have that. We are, you know, we will always have that. When we die, we will experience at some point the resurrection of the body. We will get a glorified body at some point in the resurrection. We don't know exactly how this is all going to happen or what that risen body is going to look like, what that glorified body is going to be like. We just know that we've been promised that we will receive that. We are not going to be angels. We are not going to be angels. There's somebody here I had a big argument with on this one time, that we human beings do not become angels. We tell people this. We tell them that they do, and it's a lie. It's a great lie. It's a great lie. Especially if a young person dies. Oh, well, now they're an angel in heaven. No. If they're in heaven, they're a saint. There's a difference between a saint and an angel. A saint is a human being. An angel is an entirely different creature. It is a creature that has never had a body and will never have a body. A human being is a creature that had a body, and if it has lost its body in death, will have a body restored. We are not going to spend creation as angels. We proclaim every time we say the creed, we believe in the resurrection of the body, that we are going to be human from now on. So, but what makes us truly human is our body and our soul. And when God creates us in His image and likeness, He has no body. It is His capacity to know and to will, to think and to choose. These are the two faculties of the soul. God created man in His image, in the divine image He created him. Male and female He created them. God blessed them and said, "Be fertile and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and all the living things that move on the earth." God also said, "See, I give you every seed-bearing plant all over the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit on to be your food." I'm just going to stop and go back to this. Dominion and subdue. There are a lot of people who have a lot of problems with that language, right? Because they're looking around and saying, what have we done in our taking dominion over this world and in our subduing it? Have we done what God intended? That it isn't, that language seems to give permission to us to cause harm to the earth. Anybody that's into environmentalism or ecology is going to read those and say, there's the problem. There's the problem. Human beings trying to dominate and subdue the rest of creation. And so what's going on here? I think we have to understand that the creation takes place before the fall. What God intended and what happens after the fall are two totally different things. When God first says, take dominion over the earth, all right, the word dominion comes from the word for God, all right? So to rule over in the way in which God would rule over and to subdue, it's not intended that we are to rape the earth, that we are to rape creation. That is not what God's plan was. God's plan was instead that we would be stewards of creation, that we would be stewards of this material world that He has given to us. It's this great blessing that we would learn how to live in harmony with this world. And yes, we would be allowed to take from this world and from the material earth and plants and animals what we need to survive, but in doing so we would also be giving back to the earth, that we are partners with God in creation. Some of you have heard me tell the story about the little boy who is out in his yard working in his garden one day, and it's a beautiful garden. He's got beautiful vegetables that are growing there, but he also has a lot of flowers and a lot of bushes and everything. And he's spent a lot of time, and it is a gorgeous, gorgeous garden. There's a preacher who walks by, and is standing there as a little boy is working in his garden, and he's admiring the garden, and the preacher goes, "My, my, my, what a beautiful garden God has created." And the little boy looks up at him and says, "Well, you should have seen what it looked like when he had it by himself." Creation by itself is just overgrowth, isn't it? All right? It's just kind of chaotic. But when humans work with that in a positive and loving and stewardship fashion, then something wonderful can happen. God intended us human beings not to just simply rape the earth, right? But to use the earth and to join God in turning this earth into a beautiful garden. All right? To use it, yes, in order to survive, right? But not in a way that causes destruction. It's the fall. It's the fall that we're going to talk about next time we get together that is going to be the why we look around and say, well, if God gave us this beautiful world, what have we human beings done with this? Look how we polluted the streams and the rivers, and look how the damage that we've done. Was that God's plan when He said subdue and dominate? No, absolutely not. That was not His plan. His plan was something entirely different. And let's go on and see what else He says here. He says, see, I give you every seed-bearing plant all over the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit on it to be your food, and to all the animals of the land, all the birds of the air, and all the living creatures that crawl on the ground, I give all the green plants for food. Okay, does that raise any questions for anybody? Did you read that? What has God given to us human beings for our food? What's He given? See, I give you every seed-bearing plant all over the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit on to be your food. And to all the animals of the land, all the birds of the air, and all the living creatures that crawl on the ground, I give all the green plants for food. And so it happened. See, it sounds like God intended us to be vegetarians, doesn't it? And probably before the fall, that was exactly what He intended. that somehow we were to be living in harmony with these other animals, and we certainly can use them in various ways, but the original story of creation says nothing about, I give you the animals for you to eat. He says, I give you the plants for you to eat. I give you the trees for you to plant, the fruit for you to eat. Nothing. It seems that perhaps God's original intention was that we be vegetarian. Now, I'm not going to stand here and say that it is sinful for us to eat meat, all right? Because the scriptures do not tell us that. But if you just interpret this and read what it's saying, you got to come to that conclusion, don't you? All right? That there seems in the original creation, before the fall gets in there, before we start messing with everything, that God's original creation, it was an intention that we would live in harmony with all the other animals in the world. All right? The birds and the fish and the and all of the animals. So God looked at everything that he made, and note what he says. Note what he says. And all the other days, all right, in the first 5 days when God creates, when he does what he does, creates the light, when he creates the dome, when he creates the stars, when he creates the fish and the birds and the animals, up to the fish and the birds, it was good. But he looks at what he has created after he has created the animals and he has created man, and he says, and it was very good. It was very good. Now, you can make a good argument that it wasn't very good. That the creation of human beings was, in fact, God's one reigning mistake. That the universe would be better off if we had never been created. Could you make that argument? That this earth would be better off if we had never been created. That all the other animals and all the plants of the earth, that they would be better off if we had never been created. Couldn't you make that argument pretty well? It wouldn't be that hard to do, would it? Well, you look around at the mess that we have created out of this world, out of what God has done for us. But God is saying, and the Hebrew people, they're making a statement of faith that despite all the evidence of what a disaster we have turned a number of things into, it was very good. The creation of man was not a mistake. It was not a failure on God's part. That is a question that comes up a number of times in the Old Testament. Did God blow it when he made us? All right? And a good argument can be made that yes, indeed he did. All right? It was a mistake. But the actual faith of the scriptures is that no. Despite everything that's happened, despite the fall and the pain and the suffering that has come from the fall, God knew what he was doing when he created us. So, these are the first 6 days of creation. Now, we're going to look at the seventh day. The seventh day is very, very different. But it is something that is extremely important in understanding what this... Because everything is leading up to day seven. Everything that we've seen is coming in. This is going to be the great climax. So we move into chapter two. The first paragraph of chapter two is actually... The conclusion of this first story, this first poem. Thus the heavens and the earth and all their array were completed. Since on the seventh day God was finished with the work he had been doing, he rested on the seventh day from all the work he had undertaken. Now again, if you need to believe that God was really tired after all of this, all right, and that he needed to break, all right, and that he rested, then that's fine, all right. But if you believe that this is a symbolic story that's trying to tell us something very profound and does not need to be taken literally, then you're probably you're right where I'm at on this. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work he had done in creation. So what is God doing? He has created it, and now he's sitting back and he's enjoying it. He's enjoying what he has created. He is appreciating it. He is looking at it. He is loving what it is that he has created. So creation is a big part of what God is about, but loving is also an important part of what God is about. And as I mentioned, I think it was last week or a couple weeks ago, the Sabbath is going to be revealed for the first time in the law to the Hebrew people who have spent hundreds of years as slaves in Egypt and who have left that slavery, traveled through the desert, and have come to Mount Sinai. And one of the very first things that God is going to tell them is, I want you to take a day off. I want you to take a day off every week. Now, nobody in history has ever told slaves to take a day off. Nobody has ever told them to take a day off. Only in that culture, the people at the very top would have ever, the kings and the queens maybe, would have had the luxury of a day off. That was not the way they functioned. But God is saying, I want you to take one day when you're not struggling to survive, one day when you're not working, when you're not making, when you're not achieving, when you're not accumulating, when you're not buying and selling, I want you to take one day every week to not be involved in those things and to remember who you are. I want you to take one day out of every week and to live like kings and queens, because that's what I created you to be. I created you in my image and likeness, and I want you to know your dignity as human beings. And your dignity is that you are not slaves. Yes, you're going to have to work hard, and especially because of the fall, you're going to have to work hard. All right, that's one of the curses that came upon us because of the fall. But he's saying, despite that, I want you to take one day where you don't work, where you don't struggle to try to get by. To do what? To enjoy your life, to enjoy your family, to enjoy this creation that I've given you, to enjoy what you've accumulated, to sit and be with that. He also says, make holy the Sabbath. And so on this day, what you're to do is you're to gather in my name, and you're to pray with one another, and you're to allow the rabbis to teach you and to guide you, so you're going to get and grow closer to me. So it's about relationship. It's about being rather than doing. The great danger is that because of the fall and the distorted attitudes that are a part of each and every one of us because of the fall, is that we will tend to become human doings rather than human beings. That we know how to do, but we don't know how to be. We know how to do, but we don't know how to be. This is also true very much in the culture in which we live. We are in one of the, you know, you look around at people's lives and how busy everybody is, how hectic people's lives are. And it's like, where is Sabbath in people's lives, even in kids' lives? Sometimes I look around and think, thank God I didn't grow up at this point, you know, where I had a schedule. At 7. Do 7-year-olds need to have a schedule and to have 7 or 8 different activities that they're scheduled to be involved with every week? And mom and dad, as soon as they get off working all day long, suddenly become these taxi services running back and forth and here and there. And we're running around and we're achieving and we're accomplishing and we're doing and we're creating. We're doing all these things. Is anybody having any fun? All right? Is anybody, I mean, we all these organized sports, and I wonder, do any of the kids ever just play sports for fun? All right? It's kind of a cliche, but is there ever a pickup basketball game or a pickup baseball game somewhere where kids just, people say, hey, let's just get together and let's do this? Does that happen? Or is it all the schedule and it's all competition and it's all, do we know how to have a Sabbath? I mean, certainly as a culture, we've thrown it out completely, all right? We've thrown it out completely. We have no concept of a day where we don't buy and sell. Oh, my God, that's the ultimate heresy in this consumer society, that we would take a day where we do not buy and sell. Well, who would we be if we weren't buying and selling? If we were not consuming, who would we be? And God says, it's important for you to discover who you are when you're not buying and selling, when you're not achieving and accomplishing, when you learn how to be, how to enjoy, how to appreciate, how to be with your family, how to be with your friends, how to be with your God. That's what the Sabbath is intended to be. And so he gives us the Sabbath. And says, take a day off. Take a day off. Take time to do nothing. Take time to achieve nothing. Take time to buy and sell nothing. It is so countercultural, all right? And I wonder if we can make the choices in our lives that are necessary in order for us to incorporate this amazing wisdom and this amazing truth. In a sense, we are slaves to the schedules that we have allowed ourselves to be to fall into. And all the things that we think that we have to possess, they possess us because they require that we constantly be doing more and working hard. And God is saying something else. Now, he has a great section in there on the Sabbath where he talks about the word for covenant. He says that the Sabbath is a covenant with the universe, not just with human beings, but with the universe. And he says that the word for covenant has real connections with the word seven. Now, this makes no sense whatsoever in English. None whatsoever. But he says, essentially, when somebody says that I'm entering into a covenant, I seven myself. Makes no sense to us whatsoever. But that's what the seventh day of the week tells us, is that it is a day of covenant. It is a day of relationship where God enters into relationship with all creation. And again, not just with us. Because, again, imagine in a more of a rural kind of community that we're all growing up and we're farmers or whatever. And if I take Sabbath, all right, for us as Christians, that's on Sunday. For the originally, the Shabbat was on Saturday. But for us, it's on Sunday. I take this day off. Does it just me that gets this day off? No. My mule gets the day off, all right? Because I'm not plowing with her on that Sabbath. The earth gets a day off. The earth gets a day in which we humans are not messing with it, all right? All of creation gets to enjoy the Sabbath, all right, along with us. That's part of why it's the Sabbath is with not just with us as human beings, but with the entire creation. We need to reclaim the Sabbath rest. We need to learn how to do that in our own lives, to become human beings and not human doings. Now, let's talk about evolution very quickly, because this is obviously a big question that comes here in terms of what does the Catholic Church believe about evolution, and especially the evolution of the human being itself. Are we as Catholics allowed to believe in evolution? So here's what the Catholic Church says. Pope John Paul II said in one of his talks that evolution is more than a theory. You hear creationists very often saying evolution is just a theory, it's just a theory. Pope John Paul II recognized, acknowledged, it is more than a theory. It is more than a theory. How evolution takes place is there's a whole set of theories that are connected with that. But that evolution does exist within the universe is obvious. Now the question, have we human beings evolved? And here's what the Church says. The Church says that we may believe, if we wish, in the evolution of the body, that our bodies, we as human beings, that there was an evolution from lower life forms, from the apes, all right, into human bodies. What we may not believe in is the evolution of the soul. At some point, if evolution of our bodies is true, it still required God to create a soul for Adam and Eve, our first parents, and to place a soul into that body for that to truly become a human being. Not only that, but that God individually creates every soul. See, I got my body from my mom and dad. Alright? I got my body from my mom and dad. I've got their DNA in me. I received my body from theirs. I did not get my soul from my mom and dad. Alright? My soul was created separately by God and was given to me. This is true for each and every one of us. So we believe, yes, there can be. Now the Church does not say we have to believe in that. The Church basically says we don't have a dog in that fight. If you want to believe that in creation from lower life forms of the body to the human body, go for it. If you believe that God created the human body separately and then put a soul into that, and that there is a complete break between the lower life forms and human body, that's fine too. We don't care. That's not our point. Our point is you must believe in the individual creation of the soul. Along with this is another belief that says that we must believe, if you believe, in evolution from lower life forms to human beings, is that we must believe in the original two parents. That we all descend from these original two. Otherwise, the whole theology of original sin doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And we're going to talk about original sin next week when we get into the fall. But this is part of the Church's teaching, is, you know, there are some that say, okay, with the human, it was colonies of these animals that evolved into human beings. Alright? You see sometimes where they say that there were some of these apes that were trying to evolve, that they were becoming more and more complex, and then they seemed to die out. It was like human beings were trying to become, but that became a failed line of evolution. Because the church says that may be true. That may be true. That on a biological level, that may be what happened. But that what we human beings are, trace ourselves back to parents. Now, amazingly, science has come up with pretty much the same answer. All right, science has said that just through genetics and being able to trace back and looking at all the different races in the world, that every one of us can trace, every human being in the world can trace itself back to a woman. Who I think they, I don't remember, but in Africa. All right, a woman in Africa, which is probably where life started, in Africa, that genetically they would say that there is this common ancestor. All right, so we have to believe in that. We're out of time. I meant to give you a little more time for questions. It's hard. There's so much material in here. If people want to stick around, they want to ask questions, please feel free to do so. But I don't want to hold people. I'm trying to stick very strongly to that promise that I will have you out of here on time. So let's stand. We will not meet for the next 2 weeks. And we will get back on November 1st. And to let you know what's going to go on, that is a holy day of obligation. And we will have Mass at 6 that night for those who want to come at 6 and then stick around for the class. We also will be having Mass the night before, which is Halloween. We'll have a vigil Mass at 7 o'clock on Tuesday. So, but I just felt like we're already missing two classes. I really needed to get us back in here. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Father.